Okay, well, let's get started. It's Wednesday night. It's just after 7 o'clock, and it's The Hidden Work. Once again, just to for anybody that might be listening to this later, what we're doing is we're in the midst of exploring a number of E.J. Gold's books. And we've been through Human Biological Machine, Life in the Labyrinth, Practical Work on Self, Joy of Sacrifice, and now we're working on The Hidden Work. And so we're down the road a bit. However, in a certain way, like with any episodic unfoldment, you could really start anywhere. Just come in and, in a sense, pick up the rhythm. But tonight, for those that have been on this path for a little while, we're on Chapter 5. And Chapter 5, I'm not sure if Becky and Pathworld are on, but they put in the time to do the summary for the chapter, and it's very strong. It's worth going to look at what we've got up there. And don't forget, this is an interactive thing. Here's something I want to really put into context, Ivan. And you and I were talking briefly about it before, but what's going to happen now? What's going to happen in the next little over an hour? What's going to occur is that we will take this attention and presence that we work on, and we're going to begin to focus it. We begin to focus that, and it begins to create the space that we've been talking about for the last 5-6 weeks. We are creating that space right here and right now. Does that make sense? Okay, we're not there yet. We're going to get there, but we're working our way toward there. We're starting to arrive at the class. Okay, it takes people a while to arrive because we can't remember what it was like to be in this space. Because we don't discern the difference between the space we were in and the space that we are working to achieve now. Okay? Now, here's the phenomena that will occur. During the course of this evening, we will get into a different, I hate to use the word higher, but I'm going to nevertheless. We're going to get into a higher space. What happens in that higher space is we have an expansion of our presence and being. When we allow the presence and the being to actually come out, rather than to be subject constantly to the machine and its willfulness, suddenly we're viewing and smelling and sensing a new world. Now, when we get there, what occurs is we have a different consciousness. We actually have a different consciousness. When we have that different consciousness, we have a number of aha moments. Guess what? When you have that aha moment, that's an insight that you can bring to others. It's good and you will keep it. But if you work with it in a certain way to allow others to share in it too, then you've just started on the path of doing a little bit of a different type of work. Okay? So that's my introduction to this, is that this is a voyaging project. The voyaging project. Okay? Now, Ivan, we're on Chapter 5, and do you want to get us going on Chapter 5? Okay. This chapter will take us 2 weeks, Becky and Half World. There's no question in my mind. So that's why I wanted to have the class next week, even though it's the beginning of Thanksgiving next week. I didn't want to break the class up. All right? So please.
I may be able to be here next week.
Oh, it'd be great if you could be here, Ivan. So, go ahead.
Being the Absolute. although the Absolute cannot directly alter the creation, it can, over a very long period of objective time, using repeated passages through the creation, produce change by the radiating power of influence.
Okay, so we read these things and we have a little feeling. We go, oh, I see. Yeah. But listen, this the last phrase in that paragraph is unutterably profound. Okay.
The radiating power of influence.
We can produce, or it produces change
mm-hmm.
by the radiating power of influence. There's no other manner in which it is going to produce change. So what are the two elements that we as essential beings have? What are the two tools that we have? And I'd like it if we would answer that online too. What does the essential self bring to the table? Two elements. They're characteristics and tools, but they're two primary elements that it brings.
Aria says attention and presence. Jim H. says presence and attention. And as well as Pianjo, Silverdale, Adelsim.
So we bring presence and attention, and that's all we have. What if that's tentatively, that's all we have as essential beings, presence and attention. So what is the manner in which produce change by the radiating power of influence? What is that influence? You got a good talk, you can talk well, you have a good line. What is that power of influence to change then, Susan? What is it that you can bring to the table in your activity or the process of wanting to change? Or
observation.
Well, and how about just being? The being and the courage, the remarkable courage to just be, but to be with all your heart. Okay?
Well, Pianjo says we also have adoration.
Okay, so adoration is a power tool that we bring. So our being is enhanced because we can allow ourselves to express this higher emotion called adoration. And that energizes the space that we're in. And you look around and begin to see who, the fact that you're even here, and you just grin and laugh because, yes, and it's just a revelation of being, nothing more. Thank you. That's very good, Pianjo.
I have a couple more. There's Path World says compassion.
Okay.
And Jim H. says direct electrical interaction with essential self.
About is that if the tool that you can bring to a space is the essential self, the electrical energy of the essential self. We went over this in detail in HBM. If we went through HBM again, it would be a revelation now. From this point of view, because you can see that the essential self is an electrical body. And Silverdale reminds of this often, that we're two electrical bodies, and the essential self is certainly one. So if we allow ourselves to not be in the defensiveness and ego, the fear, the ego, the pandering of the historical personality and the machine, and we can just be in the storm of whatever's going on around us, can you just be there? Then maybe someone else will resonate with that being that you have. And then maybe the world will change. We should get started. Being the Absolute is like never-ending baptism. So, what is traditionally baptism? Baptism is a signature, in a sense, of a form of initiation. An initiation in the Catholic Church, you know, you baptize the babies, and now they're part of the Church. They're initiated into the Church. Well, when you enter into the space called the Absolute, called your essential self, that is a form of baptism right then. And you're washed in those baptismal waters, really. And remember, we talked extensively in Life in the Labyrinth about cleansing radiations. So we're back to that, but on a different level altogether. And jumping ahead, when we invoke the presence of the Absolute, in much the same way that we invoke our own presences into the biological machine, the Absolute is able to subjectively experience the phenomenal visions, the hallucinations of lower order of life, which is, of course, our world. Although to us the experience may seem to continue, to the Absolute, it's a single outbreath. So what is happening here? What is being implied here is incredible. What is he saying here, Ivan? So we invoke the presence, and then it says what? The Absolute is able to subjectively...
to experience through us, basically. Experience for this world.
Now, many, many, many years ago, we were having a very intense invocation. And during the course of that invocation, by which all I mean is there was a lot more being and attention and presence there. It was hot, white hot. Notice now the space as it is now, 10, 15 minutes under, as opposed to it was when we began the class. Keep marking these things, because we notice then the sense of transition as well. So anyway, in that particular invocation, I had a specific experience of that phenomena. I felt that for a very brief period of time, I don't even know how long it was, an hour or something like that, that I was the eyes for something. I don't know. I'm just reporting my subjective concept of it. But, you know, when I had read this before and I read it again today, that's what was seemed to have been occurring. For some reason, that was the case. For some reason, it had to look in on what was going on. Okay?
Couple of comments.
Okay, go ahead, Susan.
Kianjo says, we enable the Absolute to experience the creation as each one of us, separated for the joy of reunion.
Okay.
And then there's a question from Becky Sunnybrook. Is this like waking up from a dream for a bit of time and seeing? Is this the connection?
The waking up from the dream, when we awaken the machine, we are awakening up from a dream. Our normal life, in a sense, from one perspective, is a dream. That's mostly how we live our lives.
Equivalent of a dream.
Yeah.
It seems like for the Absolute to experience that dream that we're having, which is our life, let's say, we would need to be waking up in the dream.
Yeah.
You know, we're not leaving the dream. In other words, EJ sometimes writes about, what is that called, the beachhead in a higher dimension and so on, that talk about a two-minute exercise. It's a landing place. You're creating a landing place, clearing an opening or an entryway for the absolute. To be in this world.
Yeah.
And that with the sleep, you know, with the dream going on, there's no sensation. There's no sensation by the absolute.
There's no opening.
Yeah. The absolute remains alone and isolated, let's say.
This is it's an incorrect way of saying it, but it's probably helps understand it. It's like the absolute is looking for interest. It's looking for a way, how can I look around? How can I experience the very creation that I have so created, that I brought forth? And it's looking for portals. So if you think about the fact that in a certain way you are a portal, then your value does not derive then from others. It does not derive from your ability, your actions, what you've achieved, your accomplishments. Rather, it's your ability, in a sense, to be in acquiescence and the machine for this purpose. Mm-hmm. Can you become a portal? Let's see. The involuntary process of being drawn back by the in-breath of the Absolute is called the Great Return. And each passage of the Absolute through creation is subject to this inevitable return. Okay. It is the inexorable inevitability of this return which causes the higher emotion of regret. Now, Harry Piangio mentioned adoration. So let's write that down as a tool, adoration. It's something you can work with and exercise. It's essential if that's one of the things if you want to go forward here. But now here comes another one called regret. And by regret here, we don't mean, oh man, if I had just put my money in Apple in the 80s. Oh, man.
Right.
So what is meant by regret here, Ivan? Can't cheat by reading the next line.
I can't read the next line. How about if it corresponds more or less to that deep abiding feeling of disappointment and unfulfillment felt by women when they're men turn their backs on them after ejaculation or jump out of bed and go running off somewhere.
Not what I mean at all.
Okay.
So what then is regret in this specific context? A tough one, isn't it?
Maybe. Well,
the old man in the sea. Okay, so the old man in the sea, let's talk about that for a minute. This is a short story written by Ernest Hemingway. And in this short story, it's a fishing village in Mexico, I believe. And every day the fishermen go out, bring back what they can. And so there's this one fisherman, the old man, who goes out, and he's just as poor as he was when he was a young man doing it. Like nothing different happened. So one day he goes out further and further and further. And finally, when he's out there, he actually lands this huge marlin, an enormous victory. And it's so difficult. There's a line where he goes, hand, he's talking to his hand, he goes, hand, don't fail me. Because it's so hard to hold on to the rope. So painful. And he succeeds in capturing this huge fish. And he's so far out to sea, and then gradually he comes back. And the boat and the fish is attacked by sharks. And by the time he gets back, it's just a skeleton. Short synopsis. Okay? So what was his feeling of regret then? That he didn't land the fish? Was that the spark behind it? That's the point I'm trying to make here, Susan. What's the spark behind it?
That he didn't get to share it.
He didn't get to share it as part
of
it.
Or be acknowledged.
But it also, in a sense, forced him to reflect on his life. On his life that he'd gone through, and in a certain way, nothing happened. And then he got a taste of this other event. And he sits there, and you look back, and you go, oh my, oh my. So, there's what is it in, Ivan will know. One of the Plato, what is a life well lived?
Oh, yeah, well, that's Aristotle.
Is it Aristotle? Okay.
Well, maybe. Yeah, this is, the Hemingway story, I think, is very Aristotelian in that sense.
Yeah.
He doesn't. I think Hemingway's portraying that he has this triumph, he's lived, he's achieved this great thing in his life. It's like the crowning achievement of his life as a fisherman, but it's all lost again by the time he comes back in his boat.
The external is lost.
Yeah, there's a young boy that knows.
Finds
this. There's a young boy that acknowledges that is going to live on, you know, that this memory is going to live on with the next generation, that he had this tremendous triumph. But it's like it is regret. It's a not melancholy, but it's
a form of melancholy.
It's a form of tragedy. There's a triumph, but there's also a hopelessness.
Yeah.
You know, about his situation because he's trapped in this life of his as a fisherman.
So
and he's old.
So
you know he was.
How can we? I think it's critical to hold the sense of regret, but without the guilt feelings that I think all religions hand down to us.
Yeah, I was thinking that it may be useful to think of this as remorse of conscience, what Gurdjieff
exactly
calls remorse
right on.
Of conscience, because what
Piaggio says, exactly.
The important distinction is that it's not there isn't guilt. Remorse is not guilt. It's like you go on, you just pick yourself up and you continue. You go on with the process. You continue to function, but you can carry remorse with you for an action, for something that's failed, or for a possibility that you've passed by or lost out on or something. But that's what this strikes me as. I mean, there's a regret. Wouldn't there be a regret in every return, every lifetime?
Yes.
There was so much possibility for awakening. There was so much possibility for every moment, moment to moment, to moment to moment, to have an awakened lifetime. And it didn't. And this is what portrayed so strongly, actually, Strange Life of Ivan Osokin, where the man is, the wizard, the man comes to the wizard. He says, I want to go back. I'm going to change. Everything's going to be different. I'm going to change everything. My whole life will be different. Just send me back. And he gets sent back, and he finds out.
What? Yeah.
He comes back, and he comes back again to the same point. It's like everything was the same. There was a total fixity to his life. He couldn't change one thing. He couldn't change it a hair.
So if we're, let's say we're involved in a situation where you know that your mechanicality is going to work in exactly the same way the next time. Mm-hmm. Let's say you have a friend, a husband, a wife, a boss, brother, sister, whatever, right?
Right.
And you go see this individual, and you know right now, we can drive, we're going to drive from here when we leave Ivan and go
right.
see that person.
Right.
And that person is going to be a raving butthead. All right?
All right.
We know that's going to occur. What can we do different? Now, once we're in the situation and we're in reactivity, we're in the mechanicality of it.
Mm-hmm.
But Spinoza says, and I believe it's Proposition 2, Book 5 of the Ethics, he says, you can't change anything. This is in the 1700s, actually in the 17th century, roughly 1645 that he wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
He says, he hadn't read Gurdjieff yet, by the way.
Oh. He didn't have the opportunity.
He never got around to it. And he says, once you're in the infirmity, there's nothing in it you can change. It just plays itself out. But if you nevertheless know that that infirmity will occur, maybe there's a tool you can bring in with you.
Mm-hmm.
An artificial tool, and you bring in it into that conundrum that you know you're going to go into, then maybe there's a chance to produce change by the radiating power of influence.
Yeah, that's the phrase that comes to mind for sure.
Make sense, Susan?
It helps.
So,
I do. We do have a question and a few comments too.
Go for it.
Simon asked, a remorse of conscience for not having used the opportunity again? That's his question.
Okay. How's that going for you, Simon? How you doing? How's it going this time?
He said, okay, David.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of something. I think of something repetitive. Let's say, just like there, you know, there's an image, there's a metaphor, a analogy that EJ is about to bring up in here for this. But I'm trying to think of something where, if you repeated something over and over again in your life, then it would be a smaller cycle on which you could experience this, which is to say, oh, I did this, you know, I tried hard that time, but I still didn't
get
awaken.
Like a sense of perfection in that moment.
Or I still didn't awaken, you know, I still wasn't concentrating, or I wasn't able to maintain presence, and think of what that would be like. I walk through doorways, or I'm going to invoke presence when I have these business meetings like David was talking about from time to time, or I'm going to invoke presence when I meet with these relatives of mine or these acquaintances of mine.
Is Aria here? Is she there tonight? Yeah, I remember several years ago I was down in Southern California and I was going to give a brief talk at the Jenny's house. And we were going to talk about certain features of the HVM. And Aria knew she was going to be in a car, stuck in a car with her relatives. It was a holiday or something like that. And that's like a perfect example. You're locked in there with your relatives, and you know they're the same mechanicality is going to run in them. Isn't there a holiday in the U.S. next week?
Yes, there's some holiday or other. The one that follows Halloween.
Ivan doesn't know. He's not. He doesn't stay in touch. I happen to know. So several people next week on Thursday in the United States will go to relatives' house and sit down and eat a big turkey. And some people, I think, will go and eat a ham, oddly enough, but and others are vegetarian. But nevertheless, so you're going to sit down in this tableau, and will you bring a moment of presence to that, or will you just go with the program? We'll see. We'll address that next week, too. But I wanted to move on to these next two paragraphs and get them real quick, Susan.
Simon did respond.
What did he say in the second response other than, okay, David?
He said, okay, David, still I have remorse if I look at it in this perspective.
Yes, and well you should. Well you should. If you would like a demonstration of the subjective feeling this produces in the absolute, you can begin by breathing out slowly, extending the breath as far as possible, at the same time imagining an entire lifetime has expanded outward like a bubble of air into a vacuum. In a sense, we're breathing life into existence. Then as the breath comes to its fullest extension, finally comes to a stop, imagine that the lifetime has come to its conclusion and the breath is no longer able to sustain and give it energy. Now allow the breath of life which we have pushed out of ourselves to return into ourselves, bringing the life force back to this source. At the same time, annihilating all trace of the lifetime, even memory. We have nothing in which to store memories. All traces of life are now extinguished. This more or less describes the subjective experience of the absolute. Now, so let's do that, okay? Let's do that right now. Put your books down, put your cup of coffee down, put your beer down, and we'll just for a second, and go back to it. But right now, just sit for a moment. We're going to do this very exercise. Each of us is going to do this exercise, okay? So right now, you have take your in-breath. Go ahead and take an in-breath. Now, breathe out to the fullest extent that that breath can be brought out. Breathe it out. Slowly let it go out, all the way. Hold it at the very, very end. Slowly, breathe it back in. And again, life, this is the expression of it, and now it's done. And then in, and out, and in and out, and that's, use that when you're sitting there and you're all upset in line because you're going to be late and the bank teller is not going fast enough. What can you do right then? And you can sense this form of regret that we're talking about. That's the tool that we can use that Simon was so courageous to actually bring out and put himself on the line there. As the absolute, your attention on creation is very high. What else is there to occupy it? You can dimly perceive the interior groanings of life and so on. And then once again, you are completely, totally awake, the whole of your attention concentrated on yourself. There is nothing outside yourself that you could distract your attention. Slowly you become aware of something or other proceeding within yourself, but you have no idea what it might be. It is vaguely uncomfortable. You've never experienced before. As far as you can remember, there was no one else to ask about it. You cannot go for help, nor will outside help ever arise. So, George, I think Silverdale, you're online, right?
Yes.
We've talked about that point. You cannot go for help, nor will outside help ever arise.
Yeah, listen, you know, we are, each of us represents the absolute in miniature. We are representatives of the Creator in the sense that it's a solitary path. So we do the best we can, and if we happen to be, if we happen to think we're enjoying a conversation with one another tonight, it's really us talking to ourselves and picking up a few pointers from other parts of ourselves, I suppose.
Beautifully put. In J.D. Salinger happens to be one of my favorite authors. He's written, you know, many, many short stories, many of which I hope will be coming out after now that he's passed away. Some say that he wrote a great deal, but I don't know that. But he wrote a story called Teddy. And Teddy was I think it was a 9-year-old boy or something like that, and was fully awake, fully enlightened young boy, but he remembered his passages. He remembered it, and he knew what he was going to do. He knew what his fault, but he knew that there were chances. And there's one phrase when he's watching his baby sister, and she's drinking milk, and he thought to himself, how odd. It's like God pouring God into God. And that's really what George is telling us here, is that we're all together sharing this, and in the sensations that we're able to have and work with together, we can have a sense of what it's like objectively. Okay? Try to rearrange yourself in some way to be more comfortable, but nothing seems to have an effect. There's a kind of a general discomfort of life and life overall. What can you do? Here you are. Your attention is totally concentrated on yourself in a general way with a very low grade of interior attention. And suddenly something begins to happen which demands all your attention, a vague ache, a yearning for which you have yet have no name. Think of yourself as the absolute, eternal, endless, frightened, and yet, whom can you ask? To whom can you turn? So for me, yearning is a higher emotion that works for me well. This sense of yearning for to come home. And I look for it in friends, and they're friends that, these are the friends that I have here and around me and that I meet through here. I yearn to be in that space together. And Silverdale and I have spoken about that a lot, this sense of wanting to interact in that space one with another. That's this sense of yearning that we're talking about. You know that the only answers you will ever find can only come from inside yourself. Answers you have obtained as a result of observation of a hallucination, something which has no more reality than a hopelessly complicated mathematical formula. Do you have a sense of that? That in truth, even though we come together and we have a commonality of the path, that truly the only way you will find an answer is your own interiority? Do you feel that?
I feel that.
Susan feels that.
It can be inspired and brought out by another, but
yeah.
It's ultimately they're bringing something out that was in you.
So, and this goes a lot with regret and some of the things that Simon was sharing. It's up to me. I pick up the phone, I call various individuals that I, you know, that I work with here, you know, and to work together, and I get hints. You know, I'll call Silverdale up and I'll say, how do I approach this part of the chapter? He may know or not know, but by the end of it, we know more together.
Amen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you know what the meaning is, can you really depend upon answers which were obtained from a dream? So if we get the answers, or someone's attempting to shove the answers down our throat, because they know the answers, will that answer ever appease your inner sense of certainty? And I say no. That until that sense of certainty dawns on you yourself, and we have, in spite of going as slow as we can and having regret that we're not able to go faster, we nevertheless have to have a certain impeccability in our work. I remember years ago, Claude and I talking, and he used the phrase, in a certain way, you have to pick the suitcase of certainty up and carry it as far as you're able, one step at a time, Mary, maybe. Okay? So now we're together, each of us is alone, all together again. There's no question that we come together and we work well together, but ultimately, we're each bringing our own individuality to this. That's why we talked earlier about what is your professionalism that you bring to this event that we're working with here tonight. You may have deduced the existence of others, like yourself, other creations like this one, which you have become involuntarily crucified. How can you be sure? Suppose another absolute should somehow come along. How could you determine its reality? And I actually wrote next to this for some reason, and I'm going to claim I don't remember why, but I wrote down, discuss Harry George Aria. How can you be sure? I'll let you answer that if you'd like into the log or however you'd like to answer.
Is that a question, David? How can you?
Yeah, I'm actually asking, how can we be sure? How can, and unfortunately, since you're on the phone, I can ask you directly, but I didn't want to put you on the spot at that moment.
Don't worry.
Okay, how can you be sure?
How can I be sure that what's the question?
How can you be sure of your progress? Are you on the path?
Oh yeah, right.
Are you on the path? Is somebody telling you what the path is and determining for you and telling you, Aria, that this is the path? Until something in you bolts out and says, no. But how can you be sure? What are the elements, if any? Can we speak to those at the moment?
Well, of course, and in my case, I start off with a number of suggested ideas by Gurdjieff or EJ, and then I try to experimentally verify them for myself through my own personal experiences, personally experienced, and now I've discovered over the course of 20 years that, hey, I really have made, I'm a transformed individual from when I first began. And I feel indebted to Gurdjieff and Gold because, hey, they showed me a map and kind of pointed out a potential pathway to a destination, and it's a full-time job. But anyway,
right.
Personal experience is personally experienced, arising
right.
from experimental verification.
Yeah, that's good. I would add to that something about sensations, which I think comes up later in this chapter, that you're, to me, like I think of some form of sensing or actual a body sensation or a feeling of rightness or wrongness is a great corrective to me as an isolated thinker, you know, as an intellectual centrum. Because I think that you can't be sure of it, that you can't be sure of anything in the dream, you know, where illusion is involved. And this is, you look at where he's going in this passage here, even, you know, the possibility of another absolute, an absolute, encountering another absolute, this could be a hallucination.
Spinoza
and
actually discusses that and says
yeah.
there are many, he says that there's an infinite number of realities.
Yeah. Well, and see this.
But then he comes back and he says, "But this is the one that we're working with."
Yeah, but I also like this. There's something. I'm going to need to come back more than once, I think, to that passage about the mathematical formula, because there's something in there about this too. There's a mathematical formula, and it's very complicated. And what he's saying is, I understand the meaning of it. Yeah, you know, it's a mathematical, it's very logical, it's simple, it's a mathematical formula, even though it's a complex one. So this is, and I understand the meaning of that, but the, if it's, how can I trust, but if you know what the meaning is, can you really depend upon answers which are obtained from a dream, you know, which is to say, so, some mental or intellectual conviction that I have, you know, could be very illusory or could be based on my subjective ideas or my subjective experiences. Anyway, this is what I'm saying. I can't. It's hard to imagine for me what the corrective to that would be other than another subjective quality, which is sensation, a more global kind of...
Well, let me ask all of us then.
And we have comments.
And let me ask you this too, Ivan, and I'm asking this to everybody. How then do you proceed? So the answer is, yeah, maybe everything is subjective and this mm-hmm. and that. How then does one proceed? What tools do you use?
Well,
one commentary I heard was, one thing you can do is retreat from untruth. You can retreat from untruth. What's the best tool you have? Because, as it says, in a certain way, we are alone. We can get hints, as Silverdale is telling us. But how can you proceed? Go ahead, Susan, with the comments.
Okay. So Simon is saying... Particularly, I just am in the attitude and conduct of work, but I am not certain. I just try to be. Tianjo says, when I get a glow that flows through my heart and which lingers for hours, encompassing others, there is definitely progress for this old cowboy, no doubt about it.
So people would make notes. These are individuals declaring what their sense, their ability, their sense of certainty is. There's two examples. Go ahead, Susan.
Arya said, I have found that intuitively I know that if I only, I will listen to higher self, I have found that my body in particular will create violent rejections and manifestations of illness when I am going against what is my personal path.
There's another example mm-hmm. of how do I proceed in spite of the uncertainty. So those are three different tools that people have put. If somebody could cut and paste those and said, the tools we've found so far, and put that on the website. Go ahead, Susan.
Mark Roach, for me, it's when there's lots of synchronicities and lots of things and events seemingly to magically fall into place.
As to quote J.D. Salinger again in Perfect Day for Banana Fish, Seymour Glass says, I think people are conspiring to make me happy.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
Aria says, ultimately, despite what I am told or taught, I have to choose for myself and through experience.
Okay.
Simon says, the only thing I can be certain of is that I do something.
Okay. Do something, so a doer.
Do, yeah, quote something.
Yeah.
Aria says, I keep searching, keep asking myself, am I on the path? And when I stop asking and searching, I know I'm in trouble.
I was, I think I've mentioned this before, but I was working with a guy named Richard Rose for a few years out in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to his place, and I spent 7 days in isolation. And after the first 3 days of going nuts, as I emerged, there was a lot of clarity, a tremendous clarity started coming to me. And I finally ended, and I came out, and he was the first person I saw. And I said that the burning question that came to me during this was, am I really on the path? How will I know if I'm on the path? And I was just beaming this to him, and he says, when you stop asking that question,
right,
then you're no longer on the path.
Interesting. You're no longer on the path.
That's right.
Interesting. Yeah, because I was going to say, the if I don't know, you know, if my thinking is right, if I don't know if my mood is right, if I don't know if my emotional tone is right or something, then I want to invoke presence. I want to invoke my presence. You know, to pull on presence and attention.
Yeah.
I should. I can. They get another voice or get another outlook or another perspective, whatever it is, or just change the terms. Like, this is, how would I try to get some information or some advice, some help that's not part of the dream? Well, I need to invoke presence.
So you invoke presence. Here's another very revolutionary, utterly unheard of methodology. Okay? Reach out and ask somebody else. Actually make contact with somebody.
Woody Allen gives a good image of that in a couple of his movies.
Almost impossible to do. Okay?
Molly says, stay on the path and bypass the reactions of the machine by going along with its momentum, but also use it to get beyond hurts. I will try to use the momentum.
Good. That's a technique. That's excellent. just quickly jumping ahead, the illusion of time is produced by the being's passage through these frozen tableaus, which are connected only by association. But to the absolute, events are frozen forever in still and silent tableaus. That was scary when I read that, quite frankly. It really frightened me when I read that, because I sometimes see that frozen tableau. I'm, you know, walking along or driving along, and it's like I'm seeing exactly the same thing again. And unfortunately, I don't mean it's exactly the same people on the same street. It's I see the same thing again. could be in a different city. Mm-hmm. But there it is again. And that scares me. There's something about that that frightens me. We cannot expect something to happen in the future in the sense of events, because there is no future. All events exist in the eternal moment. There is a future, an objective future, which really does carry the possibility of change, but it has no relation to the events within creation. And that makes sense, and that goes right back.
It's back to the radiation of influence.
Thank you. So I wrote a comment. Our role is to exhibit more being during each passage, mm-hmm. Simon. And is that a hint for us there? Then we can exhibit more. And of course, we're sitting here now looking back upon a life when there were times when we exhibited less. Well, let's go back and recapture the past as well. Although the Absolute cannot directly alter the creation, it can, over a very long period of objective time, using these repeated passages, the parts of the creation, produce change through the power of influence in much the same way that a diamond cutter polishes a diamond by slow grinding, interspersed with periodic critical examination of the stone. Our own assumption of a similar work on the smaller scale helps the Absolute. So this assumption, by this I don't mean a theoretical assumption, but rather our taking on, right? Am I reading that right?
Yeah.
Our own assumption of a similar mm-hmm. type of work. We take on that type of work of grinding the stone, as we said a couple of chapters ago, perfecting this passage. A little bit at a time. What can you do? On Sunday, between 3 and 7, what are you going to be doing, Ivan?
I'm going to be celebrating a birthday.
Okay, and there'll be people and wine
right.
and food. And will we be bringing a moment of presence to that? So that same event that occurs, that's occurred millions of times, not just 60, will be maybe a little different? Possible. I might be there too. Sooner or later, we each end up absorbed into the Absolute, where we wait for the other invocants to gradually show up as we do. Have you been waiting? Have they begun to show up? I think we've been waiting. And I think that there's some indication that they've begun to show up. How are we doing here? We're kind of at the end of our hour. We have a long way to go.
We didn't even get halfway through this chapter.
We didn't even get halfway through. We have to get through the next chapter, next half. I'll just skip a bunch of stuff, okay?
Well, I think this is a good chapter to dwell on. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, read the rest of the chapter again.
No, yeah, this bit. I think we need to talk about there's another. There's a handful of stunning ideas in here, but the living the life in both the phenomenal and the non-phenomenal world, I think, is a tremendous hint from the author. It's a clue. It's a it's like a tip. It's a hot tip.
Sometimes I feel like I'm an operative. I like spy movies.
Yeah, right.
But the spy drops into, a foreign nation and they're a merchant or something. But sometimes I feel like that now. I feel like I've been dropped into this to look around and see what I can discover. I'm not always sure for what or why or what that purpose is. Okay. So we're about out of our time. But let's just hold this space for just a second, okay? Just hold it. We know we have a lot to cover next week. And don't forget that people have actually put down techniques tonight. This is how these are experienced people. Yeah, we all have a long way to go, no question. But there's something there that we've put down, and let's capture that together as well. Thank you for coming. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Good night, all.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, David and Ivan.
Thank you, George.
Thank you all very much.
Okay, Susan. Good night.